First of all, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a very great pleasure to be here. I do think that I might have been brought in front of you on false pretenses. I'm not an aerospace engineer. My only claim to your domain is through some small gliding activity that I did in the past. And to being the mother of a first officer who flies 757s and 767s, so that's about the limit of my aerospace knowledge. However, I am a historian, and I've taught in the classroom for over 20 years. I'm also a museum curator. Oh, you can't hear? I'm also a museum curator of these magnificent things. And what is reassuring about young people today is that children still love aeroplanes. They still stick their arms out. They still swoop across the playground. They still fly in their imagination. Flight and aerospace engineering, even though it's not always called that in the domain or the public's eyes, it's got beauty about it, it's got passion, it's got excitement. Ever since Icarus tried to fly towards the sun, whether it's Leonardo da Vinci or whether it's Blériot flying across the channel, there is a magic about flight. Man continues to struggle to reach the heavens. And now, of course, with space age, we actually are escaping from the skies and into space too. So it's a continued fascination with the outside world, and this is something that you can build on. And in order to do this, you need to work with new materials, new technologies. The excitement and the glamour of the past is still there, but it's a different commercial world. And you need to have shareholders, you need business plans, you need to satisfy things, you've got to make a profit. And in order to do that and to satisfy these companies, you have to have the best of engineering facilities, you have to have the best engineers, the best ideas, and without those people, you won't be able to compete. And how do you get those people? You get them from the universities. You get the universities to get them from schools. And if you don't work with schools, and you don't work with education and work in collaboration and understand a little of each other's needs, one will never actually meet that need. We never actually have enough people. And what I do is work with people like yourselves, with scientists, with schools, with education providers and stakeholders, and try and bring the two worlds closer together. So what I'm going to do tonight, I'm going to try and take you on a flight through my world. I don't know if we have any real pilots with us. Do we have any pilots? Oh, we do. That's good. Do you fly with engines or without engines? Are you with engines? Well, like all pilots, you have to have your checklist. So here we have, I was told that you were going to have some nice drinks, and so I did think that we should check for our fluid intake, because it's very important to have enough fuel for a pilot to keep him going throughout the talk. And attitude. Well, I was told that you might be having cocktails before you came in, so I did think that perhaps it was important that you stayed in an upright attitude for the whole of the proceedings. Controls. I think, gentlemen, you should make sure your controls are free and easy. And if you're ready for takeoff, then you can, if you're a glider pilot like myself, you ask your neighbour to give you a little tug to get you started. And that brings me to my world, standing on the shoulders of giants. The world is a stage, they say, and so is the world of education. And it's an amazing world. For those of you who are not part of it, it is a world of dust and noise. It's a world of disgusting sticky chewing gum. It sticks to everything. It's a world of people who oscillate between hormonal depression and over-arrogance that they can change the world. It's a world where the little darlings project vomit over you, they bleed over you, and their ultimate gift is head lice. All teachers live with head lice. It's a world that leaves you speechless from time to time. It's also a very special world. It's a magical world. It's a world which is built on very fragile young people and very vulnerable young people who are looking for clues, who are looking for answers in a new world that they're trying to assimilate into. And it's a world of very precious hopes. It's also a world of despair sometimes, and sometimes tragedy, and very, very sad, because some of our young people don't get the opportunity to even live to be 18 or 19 and go to university. And what we do as teachers, we're the facilitators, we're the dream catchers. a bit like the BFG. It ought to be the BFG that's sitting up there, but I put a different kind of giant there for a reason which will become apparent further on. But just like the BFG, I catch the dreams, and I open doors, and I let people live those dreams. But if you and societies like you don't help me, if you don't give me the resources to light those dreams will die, and they will not become the realities of tomorrow. They will evaporate. Now, on this stage, who are the actors? The actors are everybody. They're society. Society is very good at telling us what we should do in education. There are parents. Parents are very good at telling us what we should do with education too. We have teachers. We have governors. Nobody ever mentions children, by the way. But it is agreed generally that an awful lot of hot air is talked about education. And as a little health warning, we do recommend you don't try that at home. Now, the situation. This is what everybody at school thinks of when they talk about science and engineering. And if you took that background away without those equations, that could be a vicar, could be a school teacher, could be a scientist, could be anybody. In these particular careers, these are the stereotypes. This is what young people think of. They are not interested in going into these professions. It's nerdy. There's no street cred. There's no visibility. There's no razzmatazz. And we have to do something about changing our images. I work at the European Space Agency, and I look for people I'm having lunch with, and I know what they look like. I look down this long, long, long corridor, and I'm quite shocked at how many 50-year-olds there are with little tufts and bald heads coming down with their sweaters on back to front. And they are stereotyped scientists, and this is not going to wow the kids in my classroom who want a flash car and they want to live a really racy life, go to coffee bars. This is not for them. This is not cool. It's not street cred. So they're not going down there. They're not choosing the careers. Then the career people, the industry and the business people say, well, we need these people. What are we going to do about it? So they talk to the universities and they talk to the governments and the education departments and say, send us some graduates in STEM activities, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And then the universities say, oh, well, that's a good idea, but actually we don't have any. Let's ask the schools. In the Netherlands, we had one applicant to an undergraduate maths course at one of the universities last year. One applicant. In the United Kingdom, we have 86 science and engineering departments at very prestigious universities, including Cambridge University, have closed in the last 5 years. And they expect another 20 departments to close in the next 5 years, because people are not choosing and enrolling in these subject areas. And what do we do with school? The school doesn't have them either. We don't have specialist teachers, we don't have anybody choosing the options, and this is the situation, and we have to address it, because in another few years' time, we're not going to have anybody to take the places of people like yourself. Already the universities are closing. The specialised workforce, when you go, will not be replaced. Teachers, you think that you can't get STEM people. We can't get teachers. We can't get teachers in history. We can't get teachers in French. We can't get teachers in geography. People are not reading pure degrees anymore. In Italy, they will lose 2 out of every 3 teachers in the next 10 years. 2 out of every 3 teachers will retire, and there aren't nearly enough people coming in to replace them. Without the loss of specialised teachers, you won't have the upper end of the school taught and expanded. You have people who will teach you games, who have done a little bit of maths on the side. These are the people who are teaching 18-year-olds. The class sizes have increased because there's nobody to teach them. So you have 40. And in the Netherlands, where I was teaching some maths a few years ago, I had 45 students in my class. It's at the legal maximum. You can't expect good results under these circumstances. And what are the consequences? In the next 10, 15 years, we will have a diminishing in our scientific and technical society. And this is not something that's peculiar to Australia or to Europe, it is worldwide. And if we don't do something about it, the most ultimate dreadful thought is collapse and extinction. The Greeks were very good, the Romans were very good, the Chinese were very good. We can't sit on our laurels and expect things to go on. We need to do something about it. Now, what is to be done? The governments recognise this. We have a lot of white papers, green papers, yellow papers, blue papers, pink papers. They recognise it, they set up review boards, they set up steering committees, they publish lots and lots of paper which recommend this and they recommend that, and some of it is very good. And some of it is just not possible to be done because it's a short term. Universities need support. The government doesn't have any money. They need a quick return. Governments are only in power for 4 years. It takes longer in education to put something through a cycle. And we in education say, yes, but you've got to tell us about it. Then we have to wait an academic year, then we have to put it into practice. And if it's a 2-year cycle for a certificate, then we need 2 more years to put it through. By which time they've all changed their cabinet positions. There's been an election and they've all moved on. They want something that will give them something that looks good, feels good, and is quite fast. We've got the headless chicks that run around. Those are the other ones that run. Oh dear, you know, it's the end of the world. And they panic and they throw things into the pot and they come up with some extremely bizarre ideas. We've got government departments that don't do anything at all. They stick their head in the sand. They know that there's a problem, but because they know they can't do anything about it, they pretend it's not there. Then we have the characters that turn up and say, hey, good news. We've rewritten the curriculum again. And if you're a teacher, I don't know how many teachers in the audience tonight, but you'd be surprised how many times we get new pieces of paper which we have to teach. Here, do this, do that, fill this in, something else. And then the next government comes along, or the opposition comes along, and they say, oh yes, but you don't want to vote for them because they've got it all wrong. And they appeal to the parents and they say, we'll change it, we'll make it possible for your child to be wonderful and have all these wonderful opportunities. And parents have voting power, and so they vote. And we have another set of rules and regulations, and we have to chop and change, and we never get any continuity. And then, of course, we have the jester, the good joker, that comes along with some ideas that really do leave you rather speechless. And none of these need to be standalone. Some of the governments can also have their heads in the sand, or they can be jokers, and we have to do the field work. The universities, they try, they do some outreach programmes, but they're very tied. They don't have time to do very much. They don't have any money. And so we start again. Industry. Industry says, we need some more people. Some companies actually do some outreach. But again, it's very spot. They say, I want something that's PR oriented. They want to look good again. So they'll have an activity with the TV cameras, but it's not sustained. It's a flash in the pan. It's been and gone. Society. What does society do? Society moans an awful lot and says, we need all these people, but not much is done. And then what can be done by individuals? And those are the things we're going to look at as we go through. Unfortunately, this is what most people think of as education. It's a minefield. Where do you go? What do you do? How do? It? With what do you do it? Who do you do it with? And to whom do you do it? These are very important questions. Sometimes scientists want to come and they want to do things, but they have no idea how to reach these people. They make things, and then they come to me and say, this is fantastic, I've made this, it's wonderful. Now what do I do with it? And you look at it and you think, oh, this person spent hours doing this, and I can't give it to anybody because it doesn't fit anything, it doesn't work. It's either too complicated or else it's too big, it's too much of a project. And so we have this problem of who do we do these things with and how do we do it? Well, I'm a historian and we could try some of the good old remedies from history. Indoctrination is very good. All the dictators will swear by this. I will be an engineer. It's very, very effective. The Jesuits had this down to a fine art. Give me a child to the age of 7 and he's mine for life. We could try that. We could terrify them witless. That's another option. Fear is very good. It usually does the trick. Doesn't sustain them for very long, but it does the trick. There's a nice story in Soviet Russia about the secret police coming around in the middle of the night. And the inevitable knock came on the door, and everybody in the house went, "Oh no, oh no, who's coming? Whose turn is it this time?" And they all hid in cupboards, they climbed out of windows, and eventually somebody went down and opened the door and came back up the stairs saying, "It's all right, it's all right, it's fine, it's only the house on fire." So fear is an instrument, but we could try blackmail and corruption. That's another good one. Kids will do anything for money. That we all know that as parents. You can get them to do anything you like if you pay them enough money. But alas, these things are not legal, and so we have to come up with a better solution. And it's not terribly magical. What can we do that doesn't cost money, that we can do ourselves within our own parameters? And it's inspire. We can inspire, we can engage, we can support, and we can facilitate. Now, inspiration comes in lots of different ways. I was 6 years old, sitting cross-legged in a kindergarten classroom some afternoon, and my teacher read a story. It was a story about the Armada. It was about sailing off the sea. You could hear the creak of the ropes, and you could feel the rolling of the deck, and it was like Saul's conversion on the road to Damascus. It was flashing, blinding lights. This was my life. That lady touched my soul. If you talk to people today who are pilots, who are vets, who are doctors, if you ask them when they were motivated, it nearly always is somewhere between the age of 5 and 10, 5 and 11. And it's important that we remember this. Most outreach efforts by societies, by universities, is to 18-year-olds. But we forget to go down to the younger age group as well, because just as the Jesuits said, "Give me a child to the age of 7, he's my flag," light that candle, and that person will have that passion for the rest of their life. And you can do that as an individual by talking to people, by telling them stories, by sharing your passion. Passion is very communicative. It's inspiring. It catches you. It's contagious. That's something you can do. Engage. That's another important thing, because you need to have the wow factor. You've got to make it look good. You've got to have the street cred. Now, aeroplanes are good. They're sexy. They're a wow factor. Use it. Support. Supporting is important. There's a difference between doing and supporting. And most people make the mistake of trying to do. The people in the classroom, when they're lecturing or whether they're teaching, they're the doers. The people outside are supporting them. And that's a very, very important difference. Give them the materials, give them the images, let them be the resource. They're the most important resource in the classroom. But they need tools and they need resources, whether it's images or whether it's information. They cannot take your world and share the passion and the beauty and the magic of your world unless you give them a box of tools and resources to take into the classroom. They have to be able to open that box or the bag, whether it's a magical box or whether it's a mythical box, and they have to say, "Hey, what's in here?" And the kids immediately go, oh. And you can take people on the journey, but you have to give them the tools to do that. And facilitate. Make sure that you can provide them with the materials so that it facilitates the delivery of those lessons. So you need the tools, but you've got to make them available. Now, things that you have to remember. Kids are different. They come in all shapes and sizes, all colours, creeds, sizes, and, they're very individual. They drive you nuts at times, and yet you love them dearly. What is important, though, is that there isn't a single solution. Kids learn and are wowed in different ways. Sometimes it's something that's kinesthetic, it's hands-on. For some kids, to actually go and touch something, do something, is magical. Other kids, they're visual people. You can show them fantastic pictures of space or of aeroplanes and they go wow and they're hooked. Sometimes people are oral or aural. They learn or they appreciate things in different ways. So you have to put a mixture of resources and tools together and know that this is how people are engaged. And then there's the different kind of child. And most people put something together and they say, "Here it is." But we have to remember that the people who come from a professional family, from an academic family, they already are aware of the fact that there are careers available. The job you have to do with them is to persuade them not to go necessarily into economics and business studies. But they are going to go to university. And so you need to wean them from one course to another and show them that they can have just as exciting a lifestyle and a career using your subject area as another subject area. The next layer down are the children who come from vocational families. These are families who will perhaps persuade their children that they should follow a trade. They've always followed a trade, always worked with their hands. Nowadays, you can persuade these children that they can do vocational courses and they can come into university education through the back door, but they require a different approach because the parents won't necessarily support going to university per se, because that's not for us. We don't go to university, that's for posh people. But you have to have a different wrapping paper. It's still the same message, but you change the colour of the ribbon. Then we have the next layer down again. We have the people who would never even think of going to any kind of education, but are actually very gifted and very clever, and they have nobody in the family who does trade, and they'll go and get a job in a shop, because nobody has told them that they could do this. But that requires, again, another wrapping paper. And then we have another layer. We have the minority groups, and we have the inner city kids. And they, again, need another approach, because they have a different problems. And we have, last but not least, we have the gender issue. And everybody thinks about girls. Girls, 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 girls don't do engineering. Boys are a big problem. Boys are underachievers. And we need some special programs and some special approaches to boys to get them on board and to give them the wow factor and infuse them and say, yes, you can do this. Now, there is one weapon that we can use. Kids are different, but they're exactly the same. They spend all their time, irrespective of which group they come from, eyeing each other off and trying to decide whether they've all got the right trainers on, the right shirt, whether their hairstyle's the right one, whether they've got the right earrings. You know, they are very suspicious and they like to be exactly the same. And that is a very good weapon because they all use the same media. They all use the internet, they all use the same music, they all use the same entertainment genre. You can use that to your advantage. Use the common streak and you can maximise your outreach to them. Another thing that's important is to be visible. Nobody knows about you. I went to your site, to your website, and it's very hard to find out anything about you. The UK site actually has some connections with education and some ideas, but if you actually want somebody to come along and take up your profession, then you've got to wow them. You've got to say, hey, this is fantastic, and they've started the journey, they've lit the candle. And it's no good hiding behind closed doors. You've got to be out there and wave the flag and say, hey guys, look, here we are. Did you think about coming to work with us? Did you think about this as a profession? And once you've done that and you've made everybody excited, there's the next step. You have to be accessible. So many people put a lot of effort into going into schools, they talk, they say, hey guys, this is fantastic, let's do this, and the kids say, oh wow, and then they come to a website and there's nothing there. You can't go any further, and they don't come back again. So if you've actually excited some interest, you have to think about how you're going to keep it and how you're going to catch it and where you're going to put it. And that's really, really important. And if it's not there when they come back, they won't come again. And sometimes it says this website is under construction, but it's been like that for months. And they only come back once or twice, and then they give up, and you've lost an opportunity. And so it's very important that you have a program that thinks these things through. It doesn't have to just be expensive, it doesn't have to be complicated, but there has to be some follow, some sequence, so that you can be visible, you excite people, you catch them, you keep them, and then you link it through to some application. Because education, although people sometimes forget this in schools, it's not just about passing an exam and a certificate. Yes, they have to do that. But it's the passport to the next step. Education is about preparing young people for life. And a lot of teachers have actually gone straight to teacher training college, and have been back in the classroom within 6 weeks of leaving school themselves. They then spend 30 years in the classroom, but they've never actually lived in that outside world. You have to help them explain to the young people that there's a raison d'etre for doing these exams. And if it's a little bit tricky and it's a subject they don't like, if you can show them what's on the other side and why they've got to do it, it helps them make those subject choices at the right place and the right time in their careers in school. And a lot of kids don't understand until it's too late why they have to do physics or maths in their last years at school. I actually had somebody who came to the European Space Agency this last week and said, I'd like to be an architect. And I did think, why have you come to look at the space industry, but he wants to be an architect. I said, oh, that's really interesting. What kind of subjects are you doing for your final certificate? Will you do history of art as well as maths and physics? Oh, no. He said, I'm doing sports studies, and I'm doing health studies, and I'm doing some technical soft subject. And he really genuinely, at 17, thought he would be able to go to university to read architecture. And the kids are not aware of these things, so you have to make these kids aware of what they have to have, the ingredients, and why it will help them get the passport to the next step. Now, things to do. Another title for this talk was Feed the Cat, because all of us have other jobs, we all have other commitments, and most people run away and they say, yes, that's fine, but what am I going to do? When am I going to do it? I've got this meeting, I've got that meeting, I could spare half an hour here, but I couldn't do that regularly, I can't do this, I can't do that, I haven't got any money, I'm not sure anybody will support me, and we have to be sensible. So first of all, know your own strengths. Know your own resources. Does the department have some budget lines? Does it not have any budget lines? Can you do things in kind? What is practical and what is sustainable? What could you do that continues the effort? That's very, very important. Even if it's only drip feed, but if it's sustainable, people will come back and it will gradually have a compound effect. Target markets, that's really important. Instead of trying to do everything and mix it, who are you approaching? Are you going to talk to the teachers, or are you going to make resources for teachers? Are they your target market? Just in Europe alone, we have 8 million teachers. That is more than our collective standing armies in Europe. You can do a lot with 8 million people. How are you going to reach them? How are you going to distribute the material or the information? And for that, we come to the next section, which are these partnerships. But going back to target markets, teachers are very good. Use professional societies. Use the distribution channels that already exist. If you're talking to teachers, teachers all have a degree. You can reach them as postgraduates. You talk to them in a certain way. If you're going to talk to children, decide whether it's going to be formal education or as informal education. Is it going to be a fun site, or is it going to be a serious education site? A lot of people make the mistake of making fun things for kids, fun in inverted commas, and they put wacky sites together, and wacky writing, and things that go flash and pause, and I can't use it in the classroom. All my kids who are dyslexic can't read the writing. All my kids who are epileptic can't look at the flash programs because it sends them off the chairs. And you have to know how to set things out. They're only simple things, but by working with specialists, they can point these things out, and it keeps the target market separate. A lot of people put communication material together, and it talks as though you're talking to a teacher, and then it suddenly starts talking as though you're talking to a four-year-old, and then it goes back again, and then it explains something, then there's an equation in there, but if it's for seven-year-olds, they wouldn't understand the equation. It's have the continuity. So target markets are important. Identify the target market and know which of your resources are best appropriated for those target markets. Now, partnerships, that's important because none of us can do everything. We can't change the world, we can only influence. And the biggest way of sending material out is like dropping a stone in a pond and the ripples go forth. by working with societies like yourself and the other branches and sending it through those branches, by working with professional education channels, by working with examination boards, by providing resources for them, by working with publishers and giving them material to support education material. These are very fast ways of getting material and information. I call it stepping stones. It's like stones across a river. And you can go down any of the stones. You don't have to use all of them. But you use the ones that best fit your materials and your target markets. And it could be departments of education. It can be professional history societies. And that's another interesting point. It brings me on to flexible and opportunities and broad ranging. Don't just think in terms of physics and mathematics and engineering. Work with people through the back door. Do what parents do when they want them to eat something. We call it something else. We dress it up and they say they don't like chicken. They've never heard of quail, so we tell them it's quail and they eat it. It's fine. And if you tell kids that it's physics, they say, oh, I don't like physics, but tell them you're going to build Roman bridges and you're going to build some industrial revolution steam engines in a history lesson, and it's history, and they've actually just done a physics lesson, but they don't know that it's physics, and they had a great time, and then they go to a science lesson the next year, and they say, oh, I've already done this, and this is history. It's okay, they don't like history, that's good. And it's the same with astronomy. You can teach it through the back door, through history. You could teach a lot of mathematics and engineering skills. So offer yourselves to history classes, go and talk to them, but change the wrapping paper, change the ribbon, and you can actually take people on the journey. And again, last but not least, remember to support and not do, because you can't do everything. It's an art to be a teacher. I couldn't design an aeroplane. I can do paper aeroplanes, and I have a good time with aeroplanes, but there's no way I can do what you people do. Being in the classroom, a lot of people think that it's easy to be a teacher. It's actually hard work, and there are skills that are necessary of pulling everything together. There's an art to make things bite-size, and it's important to recognise that. Let the experts do the delivery. Let them do the doing. By all means, go in and supplement it, support it. Be the passion, but let the teacher then say, now we've done that, and let them run with it. Let them work with it. And that's so, so important. And we have a very important resource. The most important resource is not money. It's you. It's you, me, and us. The society, whether it's your society, whether it's the history society, whether it's a school, it's only as strong as the people who are actually the members of it. And you have passion, you have enthusiasm, and collectively you have time to actually put something together. Something very simple, something very straightforward, but which is very powerful. A set of images. Beautiful, clean, crisp images that are downloadable are just as powerful for four-year-olds who's to be a teacher who's teaching about language and is actually firing kids up as is it useful to use in a technology lesson with an 18-year-old at the other end of the school. The validity of it is just as sound. So things do not have to be big or expensive. You just have to know how to do it. And the resource that we have is ourselves. We can do a lot collectively together. And so what I would suggest is that you go and light some candles. You've all got the power inside you to light a candle, whether it's a grandchild, whether it's a child next door, whether it's going into a school, whether it's just sitting and talking, whether it's going to clubs in school and doing an after-school club with them or supporting them, whether it's going to scouts and guides, whether you help out at some science days or science fairs at school. You can all do this, and you can light candles. And sometimes you won't know that you've lit candles. But hopefully you'll have somebody who comes back and says, wow, I only did that because you made that possible. I feel very bad that I was not able to tell my teacher that she changed my life and that she actually sent me to university. By the time I'd actually got there and realised that I needed to go and say thank you, she was already in her late 50s when I was 6, and by the time I went back, of course, she was no more. So she never knew the gift she gave me. My son is a pilot. he decided, he said he would tell you to the second when he decided to be a pilot. And we have a photograph of the moment. We have a photograph of him actually talking to his grandfather, who was an airline pilot with Imperial Airways. And he's sitting there with his grandpa's hat on, and he was just 7 years old. And he said, "I knew from this moment I was going to be an airline pilot." He never deviated from it. We thought he'd be a steam engine driver next week and a fire engine driver, etc. He never deviated from it. And so you really do have the power to go out and light candles, and you can send them off into the next generation with enthusiasm and with passion. This brings me to the giant that's standing on the front of the Viking. If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants, very well known, 17th century, Isaac Newton to Richard Hooke. It's actually a very ungracious comment. It was a nasty dig at Hooke because of the rivalry. If I have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. He purports to be only accomplished because he's built on somebody else. He's actually saying that Hooke is small and petite, and his work is small and petite by value as well. It's very nasty. But it's misused in history, and it's always seen as a quote of, we can achieve something by standing on the shoulders or the efforts of somebody else. It's actually a corruption of a much earlier quotation. During the 17th century, when Newton wrote this, it was the age of reason, when science began to be more formal, when people were beginning to look to scientific procedure, to order and to rigour, academic rigour. Bernard de Chartres was the rector of the University of Chartres in the 12th century. And there was a huge debate. It was really a ripping debate going on in the 12th century between the modernists and the antiquarians. The antiquarians believed in doing things that had always been done. They were the monoliths, hence the giant on the front. He is the old-fashioned giant. He doesn't change. He's stuck in the past. And Bernard de Chartres belonged to the modernists, and they said that although we're not actually very big, we see more of the picture because we're sensible enough to stand on the value of what's been achieved and to look to the wider world. And the situation we have now is like that. The situation for the shortage of scientists and engineers is much greater than just having the odd science day. We have such a shortage of scientists and engineers right around the world. We have such a shortage of anybody going to university to do pure degrees and in other subjects. And if we're going to solve this, it's no longer good dealing with symptoms. We have to look to the cause. And therefore, we need to do a sitting on the shoulders of giants and look to a wider solution. And that we are small, we are individuals. And just like Bernard de Chartres, we can still achieve something because we make an informed and sensible choice. And we don't just go down the single track like everybody else. And so, I finish with daring you to be a dwarf. I want you to go out there. I want you to use the legacy of the past. We've got a very proud and wonderful industrial legacy. But we now need to look to the future. And it's your responsibility to help create that future. Society, even if they don't have children, has a responsibility to the continuation of it. We have to hand on, and we have to have somebody who will look after us, who will pay our pensions, etc. If you're going to hand over a business, you put it in the best hands possible. You don't just leave it to go floating off. If you've cared for it and tended it and you want it to provide support for you, you can make sure that someone's going to run it, who's going to give some money into the company and make sure it pays your pension. Society has a responsibility to make sure we hand on to the best. And we should create that future. And we should continue the legacy. Otherwise, it will die. And so we have the final checks. All pilots know about these things, and guided pilots do it silently, and we do it with lust, lots of lust. And what you have to do is to look to the future. It's very important that you look to the future. Keep this in mind. Understand the situation. Understand the target markets. support. Support, not do. That's really important. And T is for try, try, try. Go and have a go. Oh, it's also for T for test, for the written paper, to see if you've been listening, which follows all practicals in flying, so through that. Anyway, that brings me to the end. It's just a quick flight through my world, the problems that we have, and what we need from you to help us help you move on and take aerospace engineering into the next generation. Thank you.